Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello, everyone. I'm Stephen Robb, and you're all very welcome back to The Tillage Podcast. It's currently Thursday morning, the 6th of January, 2022. And while you're all putting away the last of the Christmas decorations, be sure to pick up a copy of this week's Irish Farmers Journal newspaper, currently in shops. As always, to help us navigate our way through your key tillage stories of the week, I'm joined by my colleagues Andy Doyle and Siobhan Walsh. Guys, first of all, Happy New Year to you. Great to have you back and looking forward to the year ahead. I guess when I was talking to you last on this podcast, one of our closing remarks was on the weather, naturally, and how it was really shaping up to be a below average rainfall year, pretty much everywhere, barring East Cork, I think it was. That was turned on its head in many places on Christmas Day, particularly in Wexford. Andy, I think you have some figures there in front of you, just outlining some of the rainfall which fell over the month of December, particularly in the tail end of December where we were off air.
Yes, Stephen, I'm looking here at Met Éireann's monthly data for December across the country, or at least across their major Met stations. And we were looking at it being a relatively dry month, but the last 2 weeks and arguably the last single week in December helped to bring a lot of places up to close to their average for the month, and indeed their average for the year as well. Looking just very briefly down across the major tillage areas, Casement running at relatively normal 101, Cork Airport at 111, Dublin Airport at 118, Dunsany in Meath, which would be Grange, 138. Gurcheen at 86. Gurcheen is kind of stands out because Gurcheen is probably one of the areas in the country that was remarkably dry for the year as a whole, not just for the month. And the one that really stands out from the graph that I'm looking at is Johnstown Castle, running at 166% of average rainfall for the month of December. And that, of course, was caught with the, maybe not the brunt of, but certainly on the edge of that big rainfall event that happened on Christmas Day across parts of South County Wexford. And I stress only parts. Most of the county seem to have got a good old dousing with rain, but it was just extreme in some of those areas that ran across the central South County.
So what happened on Christmas Day there really kind of showed the flaws in our forecasting system, in that, and that was a serious volume of rain. Did you say, Siobhan, was it 50 mil? Was it in the afternoon in certain parts? And it wasn't forecast?
58.9 at Johnstown Castle. But I think, Andy, you were saying like there was 80 to 100 mil recorded in other parts of Wexford. Like it was kind of, did it hit a vein down to Kilmore Quay?
It hit a relatively narrow vein. So the pretty much the middle of the south of the county. running pretty much out into or close to Kilmore Quay, and Johnstown Castle would have been on the kind of northern edge, I think, of where that was. But the rainfall amounts, you know, they're just huge in terms of the fact that the volume of rain that fell. Now, lots of areas in the country would have got 50 plus mil in an afternoon or a day during the course of the year. But it was back in the drier months when land was dry and it was able to soak better. But when it falls in December and there's much more moisture in the ground, it mightn't have been saturated, but it has less opportunity to soak into the ground than it would have at a different time of the year. So it started to flow, and when it flowed, it just generated huge amounts of flooding. And we've all seen pictures on the internet of rivers flowing through houses, towns and villages, etc. I might add, it wasn't confined at all to the south of the county, but the extreme event was there in the south of the county. There were certainly lots of flooding in other parts of the county and also in other parts of the country on and around Christmas Day.
Yeah. Lots of crops flooded as well. And I saw Mark Brown and Tim Cullinan out looking at some of the crops, and there was one farmer there reporting 70 acres underwater of his winter crops.
On that then, it'd be a silly question, but how long does crops have to be underwater for them to die?
There's no answer to that question, or no simple answer to that question, Stephen, because the effect of rainfall on them will depend heavily on what the overall temperature is and whether or not they're trying to grow. If they're very definitely in a dormant state because they're closed down for the winter, well, then they could probably take water on them or around them for quite some time. But if they're trying to grow and floods come in, a few days could do a lot. But, you know, we are generally in lower temperatures with the odd day pushing up to 10, 12 or 14. But that's still for a relatively small period of time. So it's just impossible to know what the net consequence of this is going to be in terms of crop loss. But if the crop is physically gone, you know, that's obviously serious. It being a bit yellow coming out from underwater is something that you would expect. It could recover from it, but I think it's fair to say that it probably wouldn't recover fully from it, depending again on how long individual spots of fields in hollows would sit on the water before that water dissipates.
Yeah, I'm assuming at this stage the bulk of the water has receded. As you say, it could just be spots or puddles that are still underwater, I would imagine, at this stage.
And I don't know the answer to that, Stephen, but people are still talking about the consequences and they're still bringing people to field. So I'd say there is an amount of water still in places. Like, one of the big problems that you'll always get when water begins to flow over surface and it's moving soil with it, is the soil that moves is a very fine soil. And if that moves into and settles in a little saucer, that fine soil effectively acts as a barrier to water percolation. So that even when the water table drops, it's common to have the water trapped on the surface. And there's kind of no simple way around that other than to dig a hole off the edge of the saucer to let the water off and let the thing dry out again on the surface. So it just depends on how much of any of these things would have happened. But, you know, no matter where it happens, you always pity the individuals that have been very heavily discommoded, not just on their crops, but on their houses and their farmyards and tanks as well, and all of the inconvenience that it causes people wherever you are in the country.
Yeah, especially around Christmas, you know, of all bloody times for it to happen. I mean, we've been at Soldier many a time, but not on Christmas, thank God. So yeah, look, we'll keep a close eye to this going forward and see what the damage is, if indeed there is any damage on crops in particular. So I suppose moving on, I don't know about you guys, but my phone was absolutely hopping there towards the end of December. Everyone talking about gas price and a near collapse in gas price compared to where it had been over the past few months. So our colleague here in the Farmers Journal, Katrina Morrissey, she has a piece in this week's paper just kind of detailing where the prices had fallen from. So I suppose to put it in context, prices fell from around about 189 euros per megawatt hour on December 21st down to as low as 87.97 euros per megawatt hour on 31st of December. So, I mean, that's what, a 52% drop, give or take. And everyone naturally had said, what impact was this going to have on fertilizer prices? Because obviously gas is one of the key drivers to fertilizer prices. I think that one of the main reasons for this was the fact that there was LNG ships diverted from the US heading to Asia and India. They were diverted from there to Europe, I think just because Europe offered higher price, and also a warmer than anticipated winter as well, helped kind of cool things down in the gas market, or at least that's what we believe it to be anyway. But I think the question is valid, guys. If we're looking at a significantly lower gas price now going forward than where we had anticipated it was going to be, is it going to be enough to have an impact on fertilizer prices for the season coming ahead?
I suppose, look, Stephen, it's a positive thing that it's gone down, because since gas price has gone down, production, you know, fertilizer companies have ramped up production. So that's definitely a positive. But there has been, you know, when gas prices went up, fertilizer plants were closed and production was down. So there's still a lot of ground to make up. And you know, last year when COVID, we had COVID in the springtime of last year, you know, plants were shut down as well, and you know, there was issues with transport, and so, like, yeah, it's probably going to affect fertilizer price, but probably not in the near term. But it's certainly a positive thing. But we still have all the other things at play as well, you know. So we've that lack of production gone by from the last few months, and then, you know, we still have issues with transport and availability of ships and all those things. So it's probably unlikely that we'll see a rapid decrease in price, or indeed a decrease anytime soon. That's just what I'm thinking.
I think, Stephen, if you kind of try to put it in perspective, and I'm trying to remember, and I'm not in any way certain of the numbers that I'm about to give, but if my memory serves me right, in the early days of talk of the fertilizer crisis, we had been looking at gas prices that had moved, I think, from €8 or $8 per therm to close on 100, but not 100. Now, the figure that you're using is an equivalent figure, but it's talking about 180 going back to 80. So it's still down, but it's still in the area where gas price is significantly higher for the production of fertilizer. And I think that if you stand back and try to just look at the industry, I think the industry overall, particularly the production end of the industry, will be looking closely at where gas price may go, and they will try, I would imagine, to make sure that we do not end up with big quantities of surplus fertilizer in the market, so as to prevent the market from collapsing against the background of very high production costs. So I think there'll be a lot of market management in the short to medium term to try and ease back to what might be a new norm in fertilizer production quantity and cost as we go forward. But that's only an opinion. That may not be what happens in practice. But I think it would be foolish to believe that there will be an outright collapse in prices.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, no one, certainly not in my circle, no, I saw this price decrease coming as quickly as it did. You know, and it's, I suppose, growers are right to question, I suppose, having to pay what they're going to have to pay for fertilizer. But look, I just don't think the price decrease has come on time. You know, it's come probably 3 months too late, realistically, you know, for this spring. So certainly maybe by middle of next year, we might see things come somewhere back to normal, wherever normal is going to be. But it just doesn't look like it's going to be here in time for spring.
Yeah, well, Stephen, we discussed that, I think, sometime previously as well, that while nobody saw a fall coming so quick, perhaps the fall that is happening isn't permanent. We don't know that until time passes to give us enough experience of whether it's just once off caused by a couple of ships or whether it stays there. But equally, nobody saw the price rising at the other end. You know, it just happened out of the blue. So, you know, in all of these markets, some of what drives them is based on sentiment, and some of it's based on the principle of supply and demand. And I don't quite know where all of them are. But if the overall international demand for gas is proven to be somewhat lower than had been anticipated, well, that will certainly be a driver in itself in the longer term, but more so than in the shorter term in terms of fertilizer price.
Okay, and look, there is more on this in this week's Irish Farmers Journal newspaper, so well worth a read. So guys, on this week's Tillys pages, Andy, yourself and Siobhan have two pieces detailing the future policies that we're going to be facing in 2023, specifically in relation to CAP. So Andy, on your end, on your side of the page, you have kind of ran through some of the key policies in CAP and how they impact entitlements and so on and so forth. Do you want to just give us a flavour of what's in the page?
Yes, indeed, Stephen. Well, basically, all I've done is kind of just looked into what's going to happen to entitlement values for those of us in the tillage sector. Now, the same thing will happen to entitlement values regardless of what sector it's in, but I just looked from a tillage perspective because it's slightly different in that there's so much rented land in the overall equation. And in theory, that shouldn't be impacted by policy. But this time around, there will be significant impacts on tillage in particular because of the various changes in the new CAP. One of them, and perhaps the smallest number of people to be affected, but nonetheless, it's a huge consequence for those that will be the capping of entitlements at 60,000 with a maximum entitlement payment of 66,000. Now, I think it's important to stay at the onset that 66,000 is not the same calculation as where we are today, where we would look at an entitlement value today and just say where that would be relative to the 66. They're introducing a whole new series of jargon, terminology, controls in the next CAP. And the basic payment or the entitlement as we traditionally knew it is going to be called the new BIS. And for the life of me, I will not remember what all of these things stand for. I think it's the basic income for support for sustainability or those same words in the other way around. But basically, they take your entitlement today, then they extract 25% from it for the eco schemes that we must all be part of if we are to get that 25% of payment. But it's not going to be your own 25% you get back. You get back entitlement, you get back a payment on all the hectares you have, regardless of whether you have entitlements for those hectares or not. So there is potentially an income source for land that would not have entitlements, which wasn't there in the past, but it's a quarter of where we are currently. Then there are a few other deductions being made as well before we get to the BIS. So the BIS value to start with is about 62% as an average number of where your entitlement value is today, if you're above average in terms of entitlement value. And there's a whole new set of calculations to be done. So look, it's complicated. It's when the BIS is calculated, they then take off another 3% to support the National Reserve, and then convergence cuts in, which takes all entitlements to within 85% of the average national figure by 2028. And all of those things together bite fairly hard on the actual entitlement values that individuals will get. So, you know, how many people will be involved with the new eco schemes will govern the payment will be. And there's lots of uncertainties that will be there in terms of the net consequence for entitlement value or direct support until such time as all the applications are made. There are a couple of other deductions as well. There's a new what's called the CRISP payment, or what we call the front loading, where there's 10% taken off the entitlement value of every entitlement in the country, and that's used to top up payments for the first 30 hectares in every application that's made in future. But if you have a lot of land rented and a lot of land leased in, you can only get that payment on one 30 hectare block. So if you happen to
top it up to what, Andy? Sorry, top it up to the national average?
No, no, it'll just top up the first 30 hectares by about, I think it's a figure roughly of about 44 euro a hectare extra for the first 30 hectares for of everybody's application. So it's something that goes onto an applicant, but away, but it's pulled away from the individual entitlement.
Right. Look, we've talked about this before. There's been numerous talks on it as well, some of which we've been involved in. And yeah, look, every bit of it is needed because, as you rightly said, it is complicated and there's a lot in it. And unfortunately, it's when it comes down to it, it's just not good news for tillage farmers.
No, it's particularly complicated for people that are renting a lot of land, because lots of the people that have moved away from Conacre and into longer term leasing, a number of them are locked into arrangements based on a value per land and a value or the return of the entitlements. Now, the question is for each individual active farmer, what is the level of reduction that takes place on the entitlements that were leased in a number of years ago, and who will adjudicate that process? Indeed, who will calculate that process? But it basically means that the long-term arrangements that were there between landowners and farmers, active farmers, whatever the enterprise they're in, may be altered in the future, because it's possible that one particular farmer may be able to return a higher amount of entitlement for an individual leasee than another farmer. So it may challenge some relationships going forward, and that's not a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. So look, that's what you have covered in this week's Farmers Journal. So let's go across the page and look at how we can get some of this money back, which is going to be taken from us in the form of new agri-environment and climate measures. It's pretty much a new agri-environmental scheme. Siobhan, you have written about some of the measures we'd like to see included in them because they're not yet settled on, if I'm right in saying.
Yeah, so this is pillar two. So the agri environment and climate measure is, you know, what was GLOSS, and it's different to the eco scheme. So this is, I suppose, in the past, this was the potential to get another bit of money on top of your other payments. But, you know, I suppose, as Andy described, it's now a way of it's kind of a way of getting back money now. But I suppose, look, the first thing that we want to happen is that tillage is included, because, you know, we saw last year REAP was announced and it was basically a pilot of the new environmental measure for the next cap, and tillage was totally excluded. So I presume that's not going to happen. It's definitely what we don't want to happen. But looking at the scheme then, I suppose there was things that were a real success under GLOSS. You know, catch crops were a great success. And you'd hope catch crops will stay under that scheme. And, you know, the area has increased massively under that scheme. And I think it's very important that catch crops stay under pillar two and that funding is available, because, you know, while there's plenty of farmers around the country growing catch crops who aren't in a scheme, you know, it's the area is likely to be higher if it continues to be in a scheme. And we know the benefits of those crops and, you know, what they can do to take up nutrients and for soil health and everything, and adding to organic matter and carbon. And I suppose other things that we'd like to see included, like arable margins were a good thing, especially where people have maybe a poor headland or whatever. The minimum tillage option under GLOSS was a good thing as well. And then there was a few silly things under GLOSS, like, you know, tip up a pile of sand and it's going to attract bees to your farm. You know, that was, if you talk to any of the people, you know, in the pollinator plan or anything like that, you know, they think that's ridiculous. So there's simple things there. I met Paul Moore. He's a farmer down in Cork, and he's he's really into biodiversity, and he's in Birdwatch Ireland, and he was just showing me a few places around his farm where he had scraped the bank on the ditch and left some bare soil. And that's really good for some of the bees. So, you know, I'd like to see simple things like that brought into this scheme that aren't going to be a whole pile of work on farmers, but that are going to do good for the environment. One thing, look, it's probably contentious at the minute, but overwinter stubble. I mean, we have a smaller tillage area in this country now at the minute. We have an increasing area of winter crops. So the area under winter stubble is getting smaller. Under the new nitrates, they're telling us that, you know, we won't have any overwinter stubble, that we're going to have to regenerate fields. But there's birds out there that are dependent on overwinter stubble for survival. So I'd like to see something put in there to keep those birds safe from extinction or whatever. You know, in the UK, they have skylark plots. They're actually in crops, but like in Ireland, it would be a plot maybe within the regenerated field or the catch crop. But I don't know if those patches would really be big enough either to keep bird numbers up. You know, we've such a small area in Ireland already. You know, just
not to mention it becomes a target pretty much for predators, you would think.
Yeah, so it definitely couldn't be in, you know, a crop of spring barley. It would have to be in the overwinter crop, you know, the cover crop or whatever. But I suppose as well, under pillar two, we have a TAM scheme. And, you know, we see in ag climatise, and we hear the minister talking about and the department talking about how they want to maintain or increase the area under tillage, and they want the protein area to go up and everything like this. But, you know, the area isn't going to magically go up itself. It needs support. And the likelihood is, you know, that, you know, a whole beef farm isn't going to change to a tillage farm in the same way that a farm converts from beef to dairy or from tillage to dairy. You know, it's probably going to come from small areas of, or an increase in tillage is probably going to come from a small area of grass being converted to tillage. And, you know, if farmers are converting and making their area slightly bigger, they're going to need more machinery on their farm. You know, if the area is getting bigger, they can't be relying on a contractor. So I think TAMS, you know, needs to be improved for tillage, and it needs to be more accessible to farmers on a smaller scale. You know, it seems like most things on the tillage TAMS needs to be like, you know, really, it's you have to have GPS, you have to have rate control, everything's complicated. You know, and
costly.
It's a modernization scheme, but then you look at the animal side of things and you can get a grant for fencing. I mean, you know, or a weighing scales or a milking parlor, and you know, the milking parlor doesn't have to have the bells and whistles on it, whereas the sprayer has to have the bells and whistles on it. So I think they're going to have to rethink TAMS in order for people to convert to tillage. I mean, I know I'm a broken record at this stage saying this, but you know, what is the difference between a milk tank and a grain trailer? And a grain trailer is a basic thing that people need on a tillage farm. And it's also a thing where, you know, it can promote inter-farm trading as well, and can make, you know, a beef farm and a tillage farm or whatever, it can make those farms more sustainable and fill in that circle, which is what sustainability is all about. You know, we're trying to join the sectors together and get them to work together. So, you know, things like weighing, you know, a weighbridge, grain trailers, all these basic things could make a big difference on the tillage TAMS.
Yeah, look, well said, for sure. And look, you can read all that and much, much more on Siobhan's page in this week's paper. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there. I have no doubt, guys, that we'll be coming back to both those topics probably fairly soon, realistically, because we're really kind of in the heat of it as such, and farmers are really trying to grasp what this means for them and their farm, and things like this are hopefully some help to them. So look, Andy, anything wild or exciting happening in the grain market world at the moment?
They're certainly not words that I would use, Stephen, neither wild nor exciting. We've seen markets kind of weaken a little bit over the Christmas period, weakening again yesterday, having picked up on Tuesday, having weakened on Monday. It's just this kind of up and down thing that's happening. They're reacting to any little bit of news that's there. And some of it's positive, some of it's negative. There have been a few things going on. There's certainly concerns about where the weather is taking these potential maize harvest in South America. It was blown up as all good and potential to be massive. Now it's been reeled back in again, or rained back in again, with rain being the operative word, where dryness was the problem and now wet is causing a lot of problems down there. So nobody is certain where it's going to actually go, but there's less optimism about this massive big maize harvest that will oversupply the world market to collapse prices going forward. Indeed, some people are asking if perhaps they had overestimated the likelihood of production for 2021-22, and that they may see more buoyancy in the market than had been anticipated before now. So that's kind of a very quick summary of what has been happening. The physical prices locally are a wee bit weaker, possibly barely dropping below 300 euro now for anyone that has it. But it might not be that easy to sell stuff at the moment. Most of the big buyers are kind of, they've bought their needs for the next few months. So there's not that many people in the market in the weeks ahead. So just difficult to be certain what exactly markets are doing at the moment, because it's holiday season and they react to anything that's out there.
Yeah, okay, fair enough, Andy.
One thing that I would say, because it's something we didn't speak about before, it's of no major consequence to us in the tillage sector, but soybean meal has been increasing substantially. You know, soybeans themselves have gone up somewhat, but not that much. But soybean meal has gone up substantially, because to have soybean meal produced involves the crushing of soybeans for the oil market. And with a weakening oil market over recent weeks and months, the only way that crushing is justified is to get more for meal. And that, plus the potential fears of maybe the problems occurring in the South American soybean harvest, soybean meal has kind of gone up from somewhere in the order of 420 a ton to 500 euro a ton this week, if you're buying it today, coming off of a boat today. So that's a fairly significant rise and a change in the marketplace towards what had been expecting.
Yeah, so we have no indication just yet, though, if that's going to be sustained.
No, we don't have an indication, other than meal prices going forward are still fairly strong out to the middle of the year, but then they would certainly show signs of weakening. But, you know, something happens, like there's a big demand for oil that's not expected just at the moment. If it comes out of the blue, well, that would increase the value of soybean oil again, and that takes the pressure off of meal prices. Indeed, if the oil price rises, more crushing will take place. That increases the supply of meal, and that can easily then help to suppress the price.
Look, we'll move on. And so, Siobhan, on this week's Footprint Farmers, we're talking about hedgerows again.
Yeah, I suppose just a reminder, Stephen, if anyone's thinking of planting a hedgerow, it's, you know, the ideal time, especially probably on tillage farms when there is another work going on. You have kind of up until St. Patrick's Day to plant them, and there's plenty of advice there on the page. And a reminder, I suppose, if you did plant a hedgerow in the last year or two, to keep pruning it, you know, in order for it to be thick at the bottom and provide shelter and be stock proof and just be a generally good, thick, healthy hedge. And just a reminder, I suppose, you have till the end of February to cut hedges. And as well, just on hedgerows, if you've taken out a hedgerow, and look, we're not promoting taking out hedges, but in some cases it has to be done. And in some cases, maybe a hedgerow needs to be taken out and replanted. And just a reminder, if you do take out a hedgerow, that it has to be replanted, and, you know, that the department can go back as far as 2009 to your maps. And if there's a hedge out on your farm, it should have been replanted. It should actually be planted before you take out the hedge. So I suppose just a reminder to be mindful of that.
Do you have to notify the department, or can you just
go ahead
yourself as such?
As long as you plant the hedge before you take out the other hedge. And I suppose it's, if you're, if you have to notify the department if you're taking out a hedge that's more than 500 metres long, or if you're creating a field that's more than 5 hectares. So if it's just a small hedge, no, you don't have to notify, but you do, under law in Ireland, you have to. There's a thing called an EIA. So if the hedge is longer than 500 metres or it's going to make a field of 5 hectares or more, then you do have to get permission.
Siobhan, yeah. Can I just add to that, that 500 metres applies over a 5-year period, not just on a per year basis. So it's easy for somebody to kind of fall foul of it because you take out 100 metres 1 year and you replace it, but then you take another 200 out the next year, and by year three, you've passed the 500. So you just have to be conscious of that.
Yeah.
That EIA, is that an environmental impact assessment?
Yes.
So you have to actually conduct an environmental impact assessment for anything larger than 500 metres of hedge removed?
You have to get permission, not necessarily conduct an EIA. You have to get permission to remove it and replace it.
And is that through the council or Department of Ag?
You get permission from the Department of Ag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not just hedges, Stephen. It also applies to drainage and other things like that. Particularly if it involves opening drains, putting in new open drains permanently, or filling open drains either.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting. I've no doubt there'll be a lot of people caught off guard by it. So definitely, it's well worth a read. So it is, again, in this week's paper. Guys, I suppose to finish up here, Andy, on the weather front, how are we looking for the week ahead? When are we going to start noticing the stretch in the evening?
Well, I think from listening to lots of programmes on radio and TV, I think the stretches in the evening times are already there. But it doesn't mean that the day is longer. But of course, they are getting longer. But it's just that unless it's a fine sunny day, we won't notice it. And we may not get too many fine sunny days in the next few either. Just looking here at the forecast for next week, the areas that fare best are kind of fairly clear. The East Coast and the Southeast have relatively little rainfall up to the weekend, and also relatively little after that. But if you happen to be in the northwest, southwest, then there's a good deal of rain on the forecast for the next 3 days. The west as well. Looking up at 30 to 40 millimetres across those parts of the country over the next 3 days. From Sunday onwards, I think things are probably going to get, or at least they look as if they're going to get a good bit drier. Not necessarily totally dry, but drier. Interestingly, temperatures are staying quite cool for the remainder of this week, picking up considerably, I would say, on Sunday and Monday, and probably dropping off again for Tuesday and Wednesday. So I think we're going to be with a bit of hardier weather for some time to come, with what I would say is some fairly hefty wind speeds over the next week as well on certain days in certain parts.
Okay, Andy, thanks for that. And there we are going to have to leave it for another week. So from Andy, Siobhan and myself, Stephen Robb, happy new year to you all. Thank you all very much for listening. Stay safe, stay tillage farming.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.